This portion of the panel will be a moderated discussion. I'll ask a couple of questions, and then, as I mentioned at the beginning, our hope is to open it up to you, the audience, because there are so many distinguished scholars and artists and feminists in the audience, to ask the panel direct questions. So that will happen in a few minutes. We have until 1:15, so we roughly have about 45 minutes to take on this moderated discussion. First of all, I wanted to thank everyone for their presentations, and particularly to thank the Gorilla Girls for their presentation, and ask if there's any possibility that I might be able to get a gorilla suit once I lose my job tomorrow.
We always make the joke about the baboon boys.
Okay. The question that I had is, it struck me, first of all, that following up on Lucy Lepard's initial comments, that we have this kind of collective spirit that is running through the first part of the symposium with the Gorilla Girls from the 1980s, Women on the Waves, in 2000, and then Richard mentioning collectives as well. In many of those instances, and also Coco, you are sort of recruiting your collective today. But in many of those instances, those collectives were working under different conditions, and within those conditions, creating various strategies. Can each of you talk within your own particular experience of your collectives about how not only the strategies that the collectives create change, but how they change in relationship to specific conditions? So I guess the best way to start is with the Gorilla Girls, with your emergence in the 80s, and then how that relationship to the art world has changed since the 80s.
Well, that would, first of all, assume that we actually had a strategy. And in a way, we did have a kind of philosophy of activism, of activist art, that you don't do something. A lot of political art just throws something out there and basically says, this is bad. Our idea was to try, and we certainly don't always succeed, but to try to do it another way, to kind of twist an issue around, present it a little differently in the hopes, usually using humor and facts and figures, and hopefully maybe just change some people's minds. So once you start thinking that way, you start thinking, well, whose minds are you trying to change? And what we've tried to do also, very non-systematically, is kind of go wherever we can and do whatever we can. People were talking today about, you know, the big issues, and there are so many big issues, big theoretical issues of activism. We found in general that what you need to do is just one thing at a time. And if that doesn't work, you know, you just pick yourself up and do some other thing. And that's kind of what we've done.
Coco, how has your approach changed over the years in terms of even the kinds of performances that you enact?
One thing that I became much more cautious about doing was getting into collaborations with men, because the problems that were described about cock privilege in the 70s continued, and that every time I ended up in a situation in which I was perceived somehow or other as the bimbo, the eye candy of the partnership. And so I sort of made a decision to really not do that anymore. On the other hand, I have engaged in collaborative projects with people, but in a more kind of provisional sense, where we get together because we all are interested in a particular issue or an event, or in supporting women somewhere else on something, and so we'll work together towards that, and then it's over. I think one other kind of collaborative model that wasn't mentioned, because there's sort of a rosy tone to the treatment of collaboration here, is the corporate model that has also been adopted by groups in the art world and very effectively, and by young people in particular very effectively, and that you shouldn't always just sort of assume that collaborations are necessarily, non-hierarchical or designed to thwart the power of the individual. So, you know, for me, the issue is if it works, great. If it doesn't work, let go of it and move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's good for you, Carrie, mm-hmm. in terms of this idea that we talked about a little bit earlier of failure and these adjustments that are necessary and some of the adjustments that were made by Women on the Waves that you, in the end, almost provide a little critique of.
Well, I tried to be dialectical about it. But yeah, I think the question of failure with Women on Waves is central and important. You know, the vision at the beginning was an actual service providing institution, you know, that maybe 20 or 30 women a day would be just going out on these ships and it would take care of the problem of unsafe abortion. And, you know, that was the fantasy, and it very quickly became apparent. I mean, just the funding situation alone would make that impossible, let alone the political and logistical difficulties. So the question is, how then does it succeed? And I think it does remarkably. And it succeeds through a very particular kind of representational politics. I mean, it does its work in representation, but it does it by anchoring it to the real. And that's why that idea of plausibility, I thought, was a way of getting at some new kind of way of figuring success, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It seems that with yours too, there's a shift from looking, and Lucy Lepard talks a little bit about this as well, shift from this initial stage in activism of focusing on specific institutions and looking at larger geopolitical issues.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that this project is so of its moment is the intelligence with which it recognizes that feminist issues are global issues, the way that it looks at poverty as a crucial issue that people who care about women's rights necessarily must take on, and the way that it thinks about abortion rights in an international context. The sort of flip side of that would be the slightly uncomfortable ways that it rhymes with ideologies or practices of globalization and neoliberalism, which I'm putting out there as you know, a possibility that we want to take seriously without trying to say that it in any way invalidates the work that's been done, but that every action has a kind of ideological understructure that it's important for us as critics to think about. Mm-hmm.
And Richard, in terms of that particular idea of an ideological understructure, you had mentioned that at one point, or sort of questioned the notion of there being a left now, and then also an interesting critique of the sort of the masculine qualities of the left. Where do you see some of the sources or possibilities for a political ideology or understructure for activity today or practices today?
Well, I mean, I'm an art historian, mm-hmm. so I mean, it seems maybe like kind of a cop out to say that I look to history, but I really do. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, and I that's sort of the point of looking at that Goodbye to All That and at the Fight Censorship Group is not only to return to and sort of honor these amazing projects, but also to see how they could be reactivated. I really believe that the past can offer a model of difference, a different set of possibilities than are imaginable maybe right now or easily imaginable. And one of the things I wanted to demonstrate was that, you know, globalization, everyone is kind of globalization crazy right now, but in Goodbye to All That, they were thinking about what was going on in Saigon, not just American, you know, forces, but they were thinking about the sex trade in, you know, Vietnamese women by American troops. They were thinking about the cosmetics industry internationally. They were thinking about the Chicano, you know, right, Chicano reclamation of local things, but they were also thinking about Angela Davis and the Black Panthers. I mean, this was not, I don't believe, and this is Martha Rossler's point in that quote, that sort of, it was so inward turning, or kind of in so much, oh, we have to defeat the Museum of Modern Art. I mean, what's incredible about returning to early radical feminist art and ephemera is that you see it's ambitions do not stop at the door of MoMA, you know, nor at the edge of the middle-class neighborhood, or that the white women who probably were the majority of the editorial collective lived in. I mean, there was and is, I think, as Carrie is saying, a feminist social conscience and consciousness that goes way beyond, well beyond just the individual advancement of already relatively privileged women, if not privileged in relation to men, then in relation to other women. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that needs to be remembered and used, because it seems to me that the art world has become so kind of drunk on money, and I mean, not, and I feel like, I know that we all say that, but behind that, it seems to me, is a very individualized, even if there are collectives, it seems to me the logic is still one of the marketplace and is very much about individual self-promotion. So something like the Guerrilla Girls, well, not something like the Guerrilla Girls, the Fight Censorship Group, WAC, I mean, I think it's very moving to see people who are doing work that is not in any way about advancing their own career in the art world. It's pretty perverse. I mean, not perverse, it's pretty unusual, rare. It's the opposite. Well, it's the good, it's
well,
the good kind of queer.
In a good sense.
So.
Or just stupid.
Just one more question, then if everyone could line up for more questions for the group. But the question is really about this idea that sort of came out quite a bit too, is this idea of a masquerade or a disguise in the interventions that one does as an activist. Can each of you speak to that particular role with your groups or with your ideas?
Well, it was. For us, it was initially self-protective. You know, the art world was such a small, clubby place that, you know, to bite the hand that you wanted to feed you was kind of a stupid thing to do in 1984. So originally, we decided to be anonymous, and we decided to be guerrillas, you know, freedom fighters, because that also flew in the face of the sort of very clubby, refined atmosphere of the art world to call ourselves guerrillas. And we really never thought about this mask until we had some photo opportunities. And you know, we argue all the time about how it actually started, but the one story I really like is that one of the early members was a very bad speller. So she was taking notes, and she misspelled gorilla, gorilla. And that was sort of how we got our masculinity. But I think we very quickly realized that, yes, it was self-protective, but it was also a great strategy. I think the idea that it was a good strategy came after we made the decision, and that we could represent every woman because no one would know who we were. And that became very, you know, very powerful, and we can make jokes about how many Guerrilla Girls there are in the audience today. We used to send letters to, you know, museum directors sort of threatening, you know, that their secretary was really a Guerrilla Girl. Or maybe their proctologist was a Guerrilla Girl. So we played with it a lot.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a performance artist. I have characters, right? This is a character. But, I mean, I decided to do work on the military after the invasion of Iraq. In part because I was absolutely stunned that there was a total silence from the art world on the war. Then I was also quite surprised and intrigued and perturbed by the prominence of women in the Abu Ghraib scandals and in the revelations that mostly came from leaks from FBI investigations of female interrogators using sex as a tactic, as a torture tactic against Islamic detainees. And I thought that there was a political drama going on that would enable me to explore a kind of character I hadn't really been associated with, which was women in the position of victimizers, because all of my knowledge of torture and its relationship to women had been about women as victims of torture. But then the more I got involved, you know, I trained with retired US Army interrogators to create my performance and made a film about it and did all these things. And in the course of all of it, what I began to understand was that I was speaking about conservatism and women. And about the phenomenon of women's identification with conservative forms of power, that I was talking about Condoleezza Rice and about a lot of the ways in which women have accommodated the needs of the art world and work within it. And that I was able to say those things without getting, you know, acid thrown in my face because I put on the uniform. And that's why I do it, as much to talk about the art world and about what I think has happened to some aspects of second wave feminism, like the sort of commodification of sexual freedom, as I do to talk about you know, what it means to live in a country where there's a black woman in charge of an international death machine.
We're going to open it up to the audience now.
Hi, I had a question for Richard Meyer. I was very pleased to see that alongside the very well-known work by Martha Rosler, you talked about two artists whose bodies of work are a lot less visible in art history, Joan Semmel and Anita Steckel. And it's sort of a question about your everyday practice and the kind of nuts and bolts. I mean, are these sort of personal ethics, you know, because as we historicize and as we also canonize, we also exclude very strongly, and sometimes in art history, we tend to reproduce the decisions made in the contemporary day about who's shown and not in galleries and who's written about. And I really was pleased to see you do that, and I wonder if that's the kind of something that you sort of think about always when you go back into archives, and certainly it's an opportunity that we do have, just when you're talking about sort of bringing back from the archive all of this material that's of course already been edited, yet it seems raw when we go back 30 years to look at it again.
No, I mean, you've basically said the most important things that I would respond, you know, that I would say in response, except maybe to add that I think the history of art, but I would even say especially the history of feminist art, is so much more diverse and complicated than any of the accounts that we yet have. I mean, I think when you go back and read the contemporaneous criticism, and you read, you know, the sort of also not in different cities, and I'm just talking about the U.S. So I don't even have the skills. I don't feel like to be comparing it, or I haven't done the research to compare it to what was going on in England, much less in Asia or Africa. So I'm just dealing with the complexities of U.S. feminism. So it's what's amazing to me is that, you know, we hear generally, and this is much, much more true of male artists, but we hear about the same cast of characters again and again, and sort of versions of the same narrative. And it's not that central core imagery, I mean, it was very important, but so many other things were also really important, especially outside of the West Coast, you know, that were going on. And what actually brought me to the Fight Censorship group and Anita Steckel was that I had done a lot of work on the censorship of gay male artists, and I had never known that there was an entire group of artists, female artists, heterosexual identified female artists, who at the same time as certain gay male artists were fighting for kind of erotic visibility, were fighting basically to be able to paint, you know, the women were fighting to paint cocks too. And or photograph them. And I had no idea, and I felt like, well, that's an important part of the complexity, the achievement, the courage, the kind of brazen sexuality of feminist art in the 70s. So I think that there are so many more such moments out there. I really believe that, like graduate students and scholars and critics, that there's a big world, especially, you know, outside of the US, but even inside. And I just think we need to do research, you know, and more research, and find the stories that haven't been told. That's one of the lessons that feminism taught me, was to look at the overlooked, the degraded, or what might otherwise be left out of history.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
Great, who have a question?
Hi, I'm Carrie Lovelace. Thank you, first of all, for just some great presentations this morning. The whole morning has been just fantastic. And my question is, you know, what really leapt out to me with almost throughout, particularly this presentation, was how often satire is used. I mean, it seemed like there was the early mode, there was a lot of collective, you know, protest. But aside from that, you know, satire seems to really be such a strategy that's also very effective. And I'm wondering, why that is. I mean, I think the Girl or Girls talked about that a little bit, but also, you know, what is it that's about that that's so powerful, and are there other modes that are equally as powerful? So maybe Coco could, because I thought yours was, you know, your work this time was very, you know, based on satire, which I thought was very
powerful. I mean, I think when I was a Cage Savage, it was also a satire. The problem was that people didn't understand that it was a satire, and I find it's equally the case with this piece that I with my audiences when I get on stage and, you know, do an hour and a half briefing in which I rationalize torture as a form of women's liberation, that I also end up with very often a lot of stunned people, women especially, who are saying, this is so disturbing, this is so disturbing. I said, well, don't be disturbed at me, disturbed at me by the fact that it's actually happening. I think satire is a good way to channel anger and to make it an experience of reception that is not doesn't feel like an attack. It's also a tradition, you know, used traditionally by artists who want to make political statements by showing their readers, you know, how absurd reality is. I mean, Jonathan Swift, A Modest Proposal, is often my model for, what was my model for writing my monologue about torture. The other thing is that, you know, I mean, if I just go out there, and I mean, feminists are often, anybody who deals with any sort of identity category or social issue in this country is always perceived as a boring moralist. And if you go out there as an artist and, you know, just sort of cry, then that's, you know, a kind of cliche about women, weepy women. And if you go out there and scream, then it's you're conforming to the cliche about, you know, angry, hysterical women. And if you go out there and preach, then you conform to the stereotype about the left, you know, as a preaching always and sort of boring people with their preachiness. So what are you left with? I mean, it seems to me that satire is pretty much the only strategy I have left.
Well, in terms of our humor, I remember the first few meetings we had where we really didn't produce very much, but we laughed a lot. And that was very, very empowering. If you can laugh at the power that oppresses you, you somehow have, you know, diminished that power. But our things, the early posters, you might not even think they're funny. They're just sort of in your face. But we realized that if you want to reach someone who doesn't agree with you, if you can make them laugh at something first, maybe, that's a hook, you know. And it gives them the freedom to change their mind. If they can laugh at it, well, then they think about it.
Hi. My name is Judith Bernstein, and I first want to thank the Modern. I'm not part of the Modern, I might add, but nevertheless, I want to thank the Modern for making this kind of seminar possible. I think that it was great to have Lucy, who was just fabulous and gave a lot of gravitas, obviously, to the program. The people on the panel were terrific, absolutely terrific. Coco, Frida and Kathy were great. Bite every hand you get, and every hand you get a chance to bite. And Carrie, you were great with the information. And I, of course, want to thank Richard, who has included my work. I can't thank you enough. by the way, I have never met Richard before, I might add, by the way.
Just sorry, I couldn't
just
show
a
more
start.
Of those phallic screws, and I didn't have time. But
I keep on going with them. The reason I'm actually here is because I was part of the first women's cooperative, AIR, Artist in Residence, and this was a really pivotal thing in the 70s. And in 1972, Barbara Zucker and Sue Williams got together with Dottie Addy as well as Mary Gregoriadis, and they went to Lucy's studio, and they looked at all the slides, and when they looked through them, they picked artists they wanted to come to their place. They came to their place, they picked 20 women, and that's how AIR actually started. Originally, Howard Dina Pindell used AIR. She said, we didn't know what to call it because originally, you know, every dealer is like Leo Castelli, who is not with us, of course, but anyway, Leo Castelli and so-and-so. And with AIR, Howard Dina said, let's call it Jane Eyre, and then we said Eyre. So that worked actually quite terrific for many reasons. The gallery is more conceptual in feeling, and also AIR was the artist in residence that was above every door if an artist lived there at a certain period of time. I suggested 20 women artists together, twat. But I was ahead of my time. It just didn't work out. The reason I'm bringing all this up, guys, is that we.
Pardon?
Okay, well, oh, so thankful. And you know, the reason we're bringing this up, that no one, by the way, has written the history of AIR. And it is a very pivotal thing that has made a great deal of impression and has been a role model for many other things since that time. And I know that I'm one of the people that it changed my life, literally. And there was no venue for me to show the work that I was doing, and AIR made that possible. And I can't thank AIR enough for that. But nevertheless, the reason I'm bringing that up, because there are so many maybe art historians in the audience who may be interested in actually following through and writing something on, making a book on AIR and so-and-so. So I'm throwing that out to all the feminists here. Thanks. There are many. That's had to do with censorship issue that I had that Cindy's right. Bringing up. But anyway, my point is, I want to thank. There's a fair amount of people in the audience who are part of AIR. Barbara Zucker is here. Patsy Norvell.
Judith,
Mary Beth Edelson.
I don't mean to be rude. Can you just ask a
question?
I'm
now taking the whole thing. Can I tell you something, guys? If people are interested in writing about the gallery, please contact myself or some of the others. My email is judithbernsteinart@mac.com. Thank you.
Right.
Sorry, guys, for taking so long.
I also want to thank everybody on the panel. It was terrific. I'm Aviva Romani. I was completely shocked and extremely moved to see the images from Goodbye to All That because I helped start it.
Oh, wow. Aviva, I remember seeing your name in the staff circle. You didn't use last names. I was wondering why you didn't use last names.
Well, that's a whole other story, okay. And I'm not going to go on with it. But I just wanted to mention something that I think is really important and ties into some of the other discussions here. What an act of commitment it was in those days for us to do things like that. In those days, the stuff about us included going home to get knocked up a bit, getting raped, getting arrested. I don't know whether too many younger feminists today encounter those same kinds of real issues, but they're incredibly real, and at the time, it was a real act of courage for some of the people who started Goodbye to All That, who had formerly been with the Free Press, for example, to leave their colleagues and begin this new enterprise. And people came out from New York, Ellen Willis, I'm trying desperately to think of the woman who used to write for the Village Voice here in the dance department. And they were impressed that we had taken this act that they were considering for themselves, and partly because of that attention from them, Goodbye to All That got into the New York Times. So there was an immense sense of personal urgency. Whatever was going on in Vietnam or any place else was really the same as what we were experiencing at home. And my hunch is that the generations that have come after have absorbed unconsciously some of the fear that we were dealing with very overtly in those days, and some of the reluctance to use the F word or the C word, which has a good medieval background to it, is is because of that internalized fear that we managed to just go forth and do it anyway. And some of us didn't go forth, and some of us are lost. So I'm so thrilled that we see it come back.
Question?
Yeah, thanks once again for the organizers of this and to all of the panelists. I was interested or provoked by some of what Lucy said, but also particularly by Coco and Richard's presentations. And I'm interested in the question of pleasure, because pleasure is a huge part of it. We talk about humor and satire. But I'm also very interested in the quite confronting ambiguity of sexual pleasure. And I'm just really interested in people's takes on feminist sexual pleasure. I mean, coming from a queer framework, I mean, it's a horrifying confession to make, but I mean, from a queer framework, when I saw Coco enter down, I'm just going, oh, cool, you know, queer dyke, oh, that's really spunky. And then I thought, oh, no, military, that's bad. But certainly from a queer framework, we're used to kind of ambiguous and quite problematic identifications as a form of sexual pleasure, which can be a radical thing. And the other thing that you mentioned was that, you know, very problematic, sticky field of, I guess, the recuperation of sexual pleasure and the recuperation of women's sexual pleasure and performativity. So I'd be interested from a whole range of feminist activists how to negotiate that particular minefield.
So are we supposed to answer that? Well, you know, what I'm dealing with very specifically is the question of women considering, and you don't have to be a feminist to consider it, but just women considering that we might also be in a position at some point in our lives of playing the role of the sexual threat, right? And not because of somebody's mental instability on the other side, but literally because we're in a position of power and using our sexuality as a form of punitive power. Now, in the circumstances in which this has been happening in military prisons, the issue is consent, the consent of the other party. What I now that is all sounds very clear, but what I have found in my discussions with people before and after performances, and with students of mine, is that there doesn't seem to be an understood and accepted vocabulary for addressing the question of how one's pleasure might also be abusive in certain situations, and that has to do with a lack of experience in arguing these issues and a condemnation of all existing language as Catherine MacKinnon-style victimization. And the part of the reason for that is that the more familiar language is the free-for-all, sex is great language of S&M, and that you know, somebody's pain might be somebody's pleasure. And that tends to dominate the kind of Joe Common Man response to the pictures of prison abuse. By the way, if you read what people email to the internet publications, very often they talk about how they'd love to be in a prison with women doing things like that to them, right? So it's the sort of cynical discourse of S&M that dominates. And I think that where we are in the world at this point in time, and where women are in structures of power at this time, that a different kind of vocabulary has to be elaborated and understood and accepted. I've gotten a lot of responses from older women of like, oh, you're forgetting how women are victims of war. I'm like, I'm not forgetting how women are victims of war. But as American women, we're not the victims of this war. We are the perpetrators of the violence. And we have to be able to understand that and to deal with it in order to address the war.
My name is Lisa Bloom. I wanted to thank the museum and the panelists for putting together. Can you hear me? Yes. No. Okay, better. I wanted to thank the museum and the panelists for putting together such a kind of provocative sort of discussion that also sort of deals with the history of feminist art. I did want to point out though, that, you know, just hearing Richard Meyer's paper and sort of thinking about the questions that have been asked, that, you know, it reminds me of how many Jewish women were involved in the beginnings of, you know, women's art, and how that history now is only beginning to get recorded and theorized and thought about. And I was just wondering if any of you had any thoughts about that. I did recently finish a book on Jewish identities in American feminist art, and but I really feel it's just sort of the beginnings of this topic that is extremely rich and important to the history of feminist art in the U.S. So I asked Richard, because you chose to speak about Jewish women.
I got fascinated by the Fight Censorship group, and then I started meeting the women, or some of them, not all of them, and reading about them. So, Eunice Golden and Judith Bernstein, and I think Hannah Wilke was Jewish. Adida, are you Jewish? Yeah, we talked about it. You are, right? I mean, I know you don't necessarily self-identify as such, so I don't mean to out you, but I guess I have. And so I thought, is it that Jewish heterosexual women at this moment were kind of more less inhibited about sex, about their desire, both their desire for men, but also their critique of male supremacy and the patriarchy. I mean, one of the things I think in both Anita and Joan Semmel and Anita Steckel's work is that you see the complexities of fantasy, that we can have a political, as, say, heterosexual women and, let's say, gay men, we may desire men, and not to say lesbians or straight men don't desire men, but that's another issue. trans, but we may desire men, but that doesn't mean that at the very same moment where we're horrified by manliness, the construction of manliness, and maybe even the construction of manliness works into our fantasy, our erotic activities. But I think what's so courageous to me about those Jewish women, and I'm sure that, and it wasn't all Jewish women in Fight Censorship, but a lot, was that they are willing to talk about their own, about their sexual, relation to the male body, as well as without sacrificing a feminist critique of phallic, what Sue Katz called phallic imperialism. And I think I think satire is very helpful in certain cases. I mean, they use various strategies, but I do think the Jewish question is a big one. And I just there was last night this amazing series of videos of artists from the 70s and 80s talking to the Video Data Bank, and Martha Rossler just had this incredible thing about how her feminism was really forged growing up in an, I think she said, Orthodox or observant Jewish household, and her fury at what men in the Jewish tradition, what men were permitted or encouraged to do, and women were not. So I thought that was just interesting, because I think we need to kind of understand feminism in relation as a reaction against religion, but also possibly as using certain maybe counter narratives embedded, or counter strategies that could be kind of queered from religious upbringings.
Hi, I'm Samantha, and I had two quick questions about sort of reaction. Katty and Frida, you were talking about how you're grappling with this issue of sort of being accepted by the mainstream and shown in museums, and how, I mean, there is this danger that if you see a Gorilla Girl up on a wall, a Gorilla Girl poster up on a wall in an art gallery, that you think, oh, the problem's been solved. They're accepting it, it's here. And so how do you deal with that pressure and sort of grappling with that?
Well, one really interesting thing is we're not accepted by museums in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because our work critiques the United States. So we're kind of the darlings right now of a bunch of institutions in Europe, which is kind of interesting to us also. We can't create the perfect position for ourselves. And most of our work now is outside the art world. It's not even in the art world. We're here today, but that isn't our main focus. We come back to it once in a while. But I think you're right. I mean, there is that problem once you're in the white, once you're on those white cubes. does it take away some of the power of the work? And it's something we worry about all the time. I mean, are we co-opted? Are we being a little nicer than we would be otherwise? You know, we're very comfortable being outsiders. We have women in our group, we have had such diverse kinds of artists even, forget about the people, but diverse kinds of artists. And some of the women in our group have been quite successful. So some of the women in our group may have shown at the Museum of Modern Art. On the other hand, our favorite stance is the outsider, the complainer, you know, the whiner, et cetera. So all I can say is we don't have an answer to that. It's totally confusing to us. We prefer being outside.
Okay. Thanks. Kogo, I was just wondering, I saw you at the Hammer, I think last summer, and mm-hmm. it's really great to see you again. Kogo, I saw you at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, and it's really great to see you here again. And I was just wondering, has there been any reaction from the government to your performances?
I'm not that important. No, I mean, I did a performance as a military policewoman in Brazil where I had 50 prisoners, actors playing prisoners, sweep the streets in front of the U.S. consulate with toothbrushes for an hour. And, CNN and every other TV camera in Brazil was there. And, you know, it was all over the newspapers the next day. And nothing happened to me when I came back. So after that, I just figured that I'm not really doing anything that they're that concerned with, that they have bigger crises to deal with. So I stopped worrying about it.
I would also, Coco, I would wonder, you know, one of the points you made is the incredible media savvy that the military has developed, and mm-hmm. it's the thing that the yes men realize all the time is that the corporations know it's better for them just not to make a fuss about it, because the more fuel they give the fire, the harder it burns. So their ignoring of you may be tactical as well.
Hi, I'm Jen. I wanted to ask all of you a question about audience and genre, and I'm interested in what you think at this point in history, what patterns of spectatorship we're stuck in, especially in terms of thinking about the raised and gendered body, and what's particularly powerful about the genres that you explore in your activist, artistic, and academic work that might provide possibilities for rupturing those patterns of spectatorship.
You know, I'm just gonna react like kind of knee jerk. I mean, I understand from my experience as a graduate student that I should be concerned with audience and the construction of audience. I've also tried to interpret and classify audience reaction as part of my kind of post-performance chronicling of work to understand who was there and who they are and what their cultural baggage is and where they saw me influences or in shapes their readings. But one thing I don't worry about is, you know, like, is this the right audience, or, you know, is it the wrong audience, or because an audience is an audience. I mean, it's lovely to be able to work with a spontaneously generated audience that didn't expect you, because you get to sort of see your work be created in that moment. I mean, that's also one of the pleasures of being a performer, right? That it's not done before you get there with it, and so you're making it and they're making it at the same time. But you know, the problem of audience has become so much an issue of, you know, do you have an agent and marketing, and, you know, where can you get yourself into that? There's ways in which that has become more an economic question than even an aesthetic or a political one, and so I've just kind of let it go in a way, in order to just focus on working with whatever's there and whoever's there.
I think that what became obvious to us, you know, a little bit into our experiment, was the difference between the art audience, people who go to museums, and the tastemakers, the people who choose what goes in the museum. And it always annoyed me that if I liked a book and I had $10, I could vote for that author. Mm-hmm. But to vote for an artist, you have to have hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. So we sort of forgot about the collector class, forgot about the, you know, curator class, and we went right to try to empower the audience of people who go to museums. We tried to maybe popularize, democratize the, you know, the audience and make them demand changes, you know, to be proactive. Whether we've worked, I don't know. And now that, you know, we're actually being, you know, we can't say no to some of these opportunities to put our work up in museums, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that changes. But we've always wanted to empower the art audience. We really felt that they didn't have enough say, they weren't considered enough, and that, you know, museums really needed to look like the people they represent, the culture they represent.
We also think there's kind of a fake mass culture, and, you know, a lot of our work is done outside the art audience, and we travel all over the world, and we see these incredible activists, incredible feminists, committed people of all types, all ages out there. And then there's this kind of mainstream, you know, media-driven culture that people do partake of, but it's just not the real thing that it's portrayed to be. And that's something very important. We're always trying to show the underside, show the other side.
I just have one more question, and then we'll break.
My name is Mahir Neely. I'm an undergraduate student from UCLA, and I wanted to thank MoMA for making it possible for those of us that aren't local to come out here, some of us, on scholarship. That's really amazing. And it's really interesting because of all the different things that are happening in LA to be able to sort of have both experiences. One of the questions I have is, well, as one of the one important component of third wave feminism is to, you know, not speak for others and if at most allow the space for other groups of people, others, to speak for themselves. I'm wondering, in the Guerrilla Girls, you said that you represent every woman, and I'm wondering if you would be so kind as to maybe share statistics on how many women of color are in your group, and if, you know, how that, you know, works out.
Boy, that's the hardest question we get asked, and we get asked it every time we speak.
Oh, really?
Is how many Guerrilla Girls, how many of this, how many of that, how many of that? And you're absolutely right to want to know that, but we cannot tell you that. And I would be pissed off, too, if I were you standing there hearing it. All I can say is what we said at the beginning. Over the years, you know, we're a long-standing group of women. Probably almost 100 women have come in and out of the group over the years. Different races, different ages, different interests, you know, different political interests. In terms of, that's just about all I can say. I know it's not fair, and it's not what you want it to be, but that's all I can say.
But we really believe that there should be more feminist masked Avenger groups than just ours.
Definitely.
So we wish and hope that there will be more after today.